707.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The great American general George Smith Patton addressed his troops in 1943 with these words: "Battle is the most magnificent competition in which a human being can indulge. It brings out all that is best. It removes all that is base." Christopher Hedges is not a warrior, but as a war correspondent with 15 years' experience on four continents, he's entitled to an opinion as well. It is this: war is a force that gives us meaning. It's the title of his new book, and he takes us through and beyond those times when he's been shot at, captured, beaten, shelled, deported, all the time trying to file a story. But this book is more than a collection of those war stories. Chris Hedges examines, tries to understand the human condition that leads to war, what it is that motivates people who are at war, and all those people who support them. So, Connection listeners, if war is a force, and it does give us meaning, what's the meaning to you? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Chris Hedges, New York Times reporter, with me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I'm sure there are people who will remember your voice as at a time when it was filing for NPR as well.
Yes, I did work for NPR years ago.
Now, I've asked you to turn to a page in the book when this would be some time back. You're in El Salvador. And just to sort of give us a sense of the type of experience that you went through, is this a useful one that we've chosen?
Oh, yeah.
Can I just get you to read for us?
Sure. The rebels launched an attack to take the town. A convoy of reporters and cars marked with TV and masking tape on the windshields hightailed it to the small bridge that led to the lonely stretch of road into Suchitoto. We stopped for the familiar ritual of getting high, something as a print reporter who could scramble to safety I did not do, but something many photographers who would stand and take pictures in the midst of combat found a necessary salve to their nerves. Then we moved slowly down the road, the odd round fired ahead or behind us. We made it to the edge of town. We ran into rebel units now accustomed to the follies of the press. On foot, we moved through the deserted streets, the firing from the garrison becoming louder as we weaved our way with rebel fighters to the front line. And then, as we rounded a corner, several full bursts of automatic fire rent the air. We dove headfirst into the dirt. The rebels began to fire noisy bursts from their M16 assault rifles. The acrid smell of cordite filled the air. Dust was in my eyes. I did not move. I began to pray. God, I thought, if you get me out of here, I will never do this again. I felt powerless, humiliated, weak. I dared not move. I could see the little sprays of dust the bullets threw up from the road. Rebels around me were wounded and crying out in pain. One died yelling out in a sad cadence for his mother. His desperate and final plea seemed to cut through the absurd posturing of soldiering. At first it haunted me. Soon I wished he would be quiet. Mama, mama, mama. The firefight seemed to go on for an eternity. I cannot say how long I lay there. It could have been a few minutes. It could have been an hour. Here was war, real war, sensory war, not the war of the movies and books I had consumed in my youth. It was disconcerting, frightening, and disorganized, and nothing like the myth I had been peddled. There was nothing gallant or heroic, nothing redeeming. It controlled me. I would never control it. During a lull, I dashed across an empty square and found shelter behind a house. My heart was racing. Adrenaline coursed through my bloodstream. I was safe. I made it back to the capital, and like most war correspondents, I soon considered the experience a great cosmic joke. I drank away the fear and excitement in a seedy bar in downtown San Salvador. Most people, after such an experience, would learn to stay away. I was hooked.
Chris Hedges, reading from his new book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And when you do read a passage like that, full of all that sensory description that you use so well in your writing, does it take you back as well?
Yes.
And do you get a sense of both the allure of the moment as well as the horror of the moment, because that's in many ways what pulls and pushes you as you describe yourself as a correspondent.
No, I don't get any sense of the allure. It just makes me want to cry.
So when did that disappear? Was there a moment, or was it just a gradual sense of either despair or disgust with the experience?
Well, the passage you read by Patton is a statement by a junkie who's on the drug. This notion that war ennobles you or abolishes the base, I think the quote was, you know, is not true. War is a poison, and when you ingest it, if you don't watch out, it will kill you, just like any other narcotic. So I fell into the subculture that is war. I needed the adrenaline rushes that was war. I needed more than anything the affirmation of the fraternity of war correspondents, and there were people in the Balkans and Kosovo with whom I had covered the war within El Salvador. That was almost 20 years, certainly 15 years earlier. But I think that covering your first conflict, I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years, is a bit like your first love affair. And going to every war after that, you're attempting to recapture that experience, and you cannot. You can never recapture it. Yet at the same time, it becomes very hard to live outside of the culture that is war. It becomes part of your identity. You feel alienated, deeply alienated from peacetime society. I think, even look on that society with a certain amount of disdain. So you fall into, I think the analogy with the drug is correct. You fall into the culture of war, or as if an addict would fall into the drug culture. By the time I covered the war in Kosovo, I knew how to do it. I take the job seriously. I mean, I'm a professional, but I grit my teeth when I did it. I had none of the zip. I felt, I think, by then, and of course I'd already been in Sarajevo covering the war in Bosnia, and then with the Dayton, the end of the war. I felt profoundly alone, and I knew it was time to stop. Those that don't stop often end up dead, like my friend Kurt Schork, who was a correspondent for Reuters, who couldn't let go, who I covered the Kurds in northern Iraq with him, and then we were in Sarajevo and Kosovo together. He was killed in an ambush in Sierra Leone in May 2000. If you can't let go, ultimately, war will consume you, and I understood that. But nevertheless, it took me probably 2 or 3 years to really break free, to break free from that grip. It's difficult. It's very difficult.
When I first picked up your book and read the cover, "War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning," and I paused and I thought, well, I wonder what he meant. And then I'm in the introduction and I read, this is your writing, "The enduring attraction of war is this: even with its destruction and carnage, it can give us what we long for in life. It can give us purpose, meaning, a reason for living. Only when we're in the midst of conflict does the shallowness and vapidness of much of our lives become apparent. Trivia dominates our conversations and increasingly our airwaves, and war is an enticing elixir. It gives us resolve, a cause. It allows us to be noble." That, in your experience, isn't just the soldier, isn't just the reporter, has every bit to do with the people who are behind whatever the cause being discussed might be, right?
That's very true. And the experience for the soldier or for the person who is involved in combat is different from those that are not involved in combat. And it creates a huge gulf between, I mean, you always see this huge gulf between those who support the war from the home front and from the soldiers that, after literally a few minutes of combat, and I think the passage that you had me read illustrates that, understand almost instantaneously that the myth that they have been peddled by the state, by the press, by novelists, historians, and others is a lie.
Well, let me ask you to give us an example of something that's more current that many of us will know. The Gulf War,
right.
1991. You go over to Saudi Arabia like all the other reporters, except you choose not to take part in the pools that march reporters around the desert, spend a lot of time on your own, get into some very dangerous situations. But the American soldiers that you're talking to over there, are they telling you something which is dramatically different from that rah-rah sense of war back in the United States?
Yeah, they were disgusted by that. I was with the Marine Corps on the eve of the – well, I spent pretty much 3 months with the Marine Corps, but was with them on the eve of the invasion of Kuwait. And they were appalled by the jingoism. Soldiers, before real battles, vomit, cry, write last letters home. And when they look out and see the kind of flag waving and the euphoria that – and the sense of empowerment that infects a nation that goes into war, they recognize that their experience is so different and so deeply alienated from the experience of the others that they can only identify with a unit. And you see this in every conflict. There becomes, essentially what you see is that, there are two types of there are two ways to view war, one sensory and one mythic. And once you get into combat, it becomes sensory, it becomes visceral. You can't sustain the myth. And those on the home front still believe the lie. And I suppose that lie is necessary. The state needs it. Otherwise, you're not going to get people to go into war. You're not going to get young men to do it, and you're not going to get nations to support war efforts unless you perpetuate that myth. I think it's fundamental to any imperium.
Over the course of your time in different conflict zones, I was struck as I made my way through the book at the way that the images just kind of like swirl around. One minute I'm in Guatemala, the next I'm in Bosnia, then I'm in northern Iraq. Is that the way it sits in your brain? Is that the way you wanted to present it as a writer?
Yes, because I did not want to write a book of my memoirs as a war correspondent and with, one little anecdote after another. It was not what I wanted to do. I wanted to write a book that tried to explain the generic quality of war itself, the myth, the seduction of battle, the perversion of war, that battle of between the forces of life, which Freud calls Eros, and the forces of death, which Freud calls Thanatos. This battle that he believes is constant within human society and will never leave, will always be a part of human society. And for that reason, of course, Freud was highly pessimistic that we would ever eradicate war. So that, in a sense, I was only looking for things to illustrate these points, and that's why you see that swirl that you so correctly bring up.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Chris Hedges is my guest. We're talking about the perversion of war, Thanatos, the death wish that drives us in human spirit. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to have you join us about your sense, particularly at this time, of the meaning of war. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University.
My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking with Chris Hedges about his new book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Now, for the past 12 years, Chris has been a reporter for The New York Times. Before that, he was with NPR, reporting on conflicts in Central and South America. In August 1984, he was in El Salvador. There had been reports of a massacre by Salvadoran troops who'd received U.S. training. Along with an armed rebel guard, he went to investigate. Here's what he found.
Rusting tin cans of beans and fruit cocktails discarded by government forces littered the road in overgrown town plazas. The rebel escort, after proposing that a sign be left on our car saying it is prohibited to touch this car by order of the guerrillas, took us to two of the alleged massacre sites. The first site was at a wooden outhouse. where we were forced to cover our faces with plastic bags because of the stench of decaying bodies. Residents here said that the government forces burn the bodies of six elderly women and stuff their remains down the portals of the facility.
1984. That was a long time ago. You remember that story?
I don't. I'm trying to remember it now. I mean, unfortunately, mass graves have been a part of my life for a long time.
And your description of what it's like to stand at the edge of a mass grave and to talk to the relatives who are standing around hoping to find someone who's lost and hoping not to find someone who's lost, and the smell of unearthing those mass graves. I've worked in similar places to you, and I'm struck as I read what you write and how you tell a story, how much weight you put on that sensory side of the description.
I think that it's finally the image that speaks to us most powerfully. One tries to write that as dispassionately as possible because you don't want to clutter up your writing with any sort of unnecessary or purple adjectives that will get in the way of sort of explaining what these people are going through. But those scenes are very powerful, and they bring up this issue of that final need that we all have of closure, the need for the body, which is so fundamental. And oftentimes these mass graves are being unearthed years after the event. I mean, I remember in northern Iraq, after the Iraqis withdrew from the Kurdish-held areas in the north and there was this safe haven, the Baghdad regime had murdered, and many of these people had disappeared. I mean, I think estimates are up to 180,000 in Anfal and stuff, Kurds. And we would unearth, or I was present when they were unearthing mass graves with as many as 1,500 bodies. And mothers would show up with, they would carry framed portraits of their husbands or their sons. Usually these were men. And you would have to identify them by bits of clothing because the flesh had disintegrated. But there was that fervent desire to know, to get the body. And it's been a part of every conflict that I've been in. And by not returning the body, by disappearing someone the way the Argentines did in the Dirty War, it prolongs the kind of torture. It creates a kind of horrific instability, emotional instability, that compounds the atrocity itself, so that not returning the corpse, not allowing that closure, is also part of the atrocity.
War is a force that gives us meaning, and the tone of voice that I'm hearing from you as you describe those, it's actually not really what's stated in the title. It's a pretty dark reverse side of that. I mean, it's a meaning that you would sooner we did without.
Well, I think the problem is that in war, the way we're sold, some of the things we're sold are that are told to us about the myth of war are true. It is exciting. It does allow us to rise above our small stations in life. It does allow us to ennoble ourselves. You saw this after the attacks in 9/11, where the patriotic jingoism became very thinly veiled self-glorification, which is always true in wartime. And having been in many conflicts, our response to the attacks were like the responses that I'd seen at the beginning of other conflicts. You know, usually war starts with the murder of your innocence. Sometimes those events are fiction. Sometimes they're not. In the war in the Balkans, there was one incident of a wedding party being fired upon. In the war in El Salvador, you had peaceful demonstrators in 1979 gunned down by the police and the military with machine guns in the street, which was a very real event. But then suddenly after that, it becomes the dead who speak, and one cannot question that what is essentially a call for vengeance on the part of the dead. But it does give you a sense of meaning. The problem is that the cost is, I mean, war is a god, as the ancient Greeks and Romans knew. And it begins with the sacrifice of the other. And I think finally, if when prosecuted to its end, always ends with a kind of self-sacrifice.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Chris Hedges is my guest. We're going to Burlington, North Carolina now. Suzanne is on the line. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. I'm so glad that a program like this is on, especially today. We're also hyper-patriotic in these times, and war can destroy the soul of a person. In 1980, my son was part of a group called the Navy SEALs, and he psyched out of the Navy. He saw six of his buddies die during training, and the deaths were, you know, from live ammunition or from accidents. And he was a very sensitive young man and just couldn't take it. And when the psychiatrist called us, we went to Norfolk, Virginia to see him, and the thing they told us is your son should never have been a Navy SEAL because he has too much conscience. And his life has changed so much since that time, and he's doing well in managing his life, but war can just destroy a person, and war is wrong, and it's immoral. And so to have this program on today is a great gift. Thank you so very much.
Suzanne, thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Well, I think she captures a fundamental point, that war is a poison. And I'm not a pacifist. I think that there are times, you know, that, you know, the destructive power of war, which she so eloquently noted in the case of her son, does not absolve us from the ethics of responsibility. I was in Bosnia during the war. I believed, I think, by like most people who were in Sarajevo, that what the Serbs were doing was a crime, that we should have intervened much earlier. I think we bear a certain responsibility for the massacres in Rwanda and Burundi because we did not intervene. I supported the intervention in Kosovo. But one must always prosecute war with the understanding that war's incredible destructive power, not only to the other but to ourselves. And that's what frightens me about the current climate. We have turned war into a vast video arcade game, and we believe too much the myth and the euphoria of war. And always imperial powers throughout history that fall for that myth, believe in their own omnipotence, court their own destruction. You know, war has become for us a game in the same way that it was a game for the aristocracy, for much of the European aristocracy, but at the end of the 19th century. And look where they ended up.
We're going to Medford, Massachusetts, and Peter's been waiting. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you? Without trying to sound like a warmonger, and I certainly am not, I happen to be a Marine Corps, 1st Marine Division combat veteran of Vietnam, and I would start as a general proposition, most combat veterans are very reluctant to see troops get committed into war situations unless we really know what we're doing and we're going to support them. And I mean, that would be the first statement I said. The second thing I would, though, I take strong objection to some of, you know, the reporters and your guest. I have not read his book, so I'm not really qualified to analyze the book, but it's been my experience with a lot of war correspondents. They have not been in sustained combat. They have not been in operations where they've seen, I'm talking about, I guess, combat as a versus generically war. And sometimes they, you know, the statements they make that, now I heard your guest saying he was with the Marines at Kuwait, during the Battle of Kuwait. Now, most of those Marines who were in there had been in their first combat experience, and I would would assume that if you talk with these guys afterwards, what really boils down to most of these, with war fighting, in which what we need a veteran, you know, people who are trained to go to war. Nobody wants to go to war, but you have to be trained and you have to have like a warrior mentality. And I think, as your guest rightfully pointed out, that what is the most important with Marines and Army and men who are doing fighting is their unit, their platoon, their squad. And that's what they focus on. And but I guess the comment I'm trying to say is that sometimes it galls me when I hear these reporters come back, and you know but in my experience as a participant at Way City, Quezon, and other periods, these correspondents came in after the battles. They had an agenda. They came up to us. Very rarely did we ever want to talk with them because it was usually negative. They were asking, you know, things about you guys doing dope and crazy things like that. They wanted to report back at home because they had an agenda. They were usually against the military. And again, I'm not talking.
Peter, let me get my guest's name is Chris, by the way. I'm going to let him talk.
Sure.
I think you raise a lot of good points. I mean, you know, one of the things you find when you cover a war is that the vast majority of reporters don't want to leave the hotel. You certainly saw this in the Persian Gulf War, where the pool system was set up by the military but administered by the press. And without the cooperation of the press, that pool system, which was very, very restrictive and essentially allowed no movement and reduced most reporters to rewriting pool reports back in the hotel, was one that many of those reporters really wanted because they didn't want to go out. So I think you have a good point. However, you know, my situation was different. Certainly in the war in El Salvador, we were out by foot with both sides all the time. Or if you take the situation in Sarajevo, once you entered the city was completely besieged and they were dropping huge shells, 155s, Katusha rockets, 90-millimeter tank rounds, up to 2,000 a day, sniper fire, 4 to 5 dead a day, 2 dozen wounded a day. When you spend a few weeks in a situation like that, that you know, you're not a visitor anymore. So I think you raise a very good point. I think it's a criticism of much of the press that I would agree with. But I think there are reporters and photographers, especially photographers, who are out a lot and out all the time. And they're, in my mind, the good ones.
May I comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no. I just want to make to emphasize. I am not at all talking about. I absolutely agree about the most guys who are in combat. They're not impressed with anybody waving flags about that. But what happens? I can only speak from Marine Corps combat experience. What happens? I think maybe there's an adverse ratio with the hard circumstances you're under. That your whole world revolves around your squad, your platoon, your company, and your mission, and it turns. And I also have to emphasize, if we're in war, you need people who are warriors. You have to, and I don't think history, there's any, you know, nation that has survived that doesn't have warriors, cannot survive without having a warrior mentality when you have to put people in harm's way.
Peter, when you reflect back on your time in Vietnam, do you look at that as a time that gave you some meaning in your life?
Let me tell you, I happen to be, I went to college and law school. I raised 2 great kids, and I attribute it to my late wife. The most important thing I ever did in my life, I was a good combat Marine. I spent 5 months in Chelsea Naval Hospital being wounded, and I look back at the men I still am in touch with, my outfit from Hotel Company, 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines. I attribute those to the finest people I've ever been involved with, and I still stay in touch with them, and it's the proudest accomplishment of my life, in the sense that I did the best I could, and I never let anybody get killed that I knew of through screwing up, and that's the finest group of people I ever had. Now, I can honestly say, would I want my son to have done that? No. I wouldn't want. And do I want anybody else's kid to have to go through it? No. But if we're going to be there and fight, I want them to be, you know, have that type of training and have that type of unity so that they can go out, do their mission, survive, and come back.
Peter, thanks a lot for your call. It was
Thank
great
you.
To have
Bye.
You on the program. To Dedham, Massachusetts, and George is waiting. George.
Yes. I was in the Korean War, and it was right after it was over when I got to Korea. There was still some very, very difficult, immoral, horrid attitudes on the part of even of my own friends in the service. But the point that I want to get to had nothing to do with the war. It had to do with this drive inside between, you might say, war and the rush that comes from being involved. I came around. This is an analogy, a story to make my point. Not long ago, 2 or 3 years ago, I came around a curve on a road and noticed a horrific accident in front of me. It was a motorcycle that had gone around that same curve ahead of me. There was no way that you could get around that curve unless you're on your own side, but you'd be taking a chance by hitting another car or hitting something head on. He took that chance, and I'm sure there was a rush, because we've all had experiences where you come close to something, but you think, wow. And there's a deep, deep drive inside. You might even call it a death drive. Well, whatever it is that you were mentioning before about Freud saying this deep, important, this fundamental, visceral thing that's within us. But anyway, whatever that did, he and his rider on the back were killed. She went right over the top of the car in front. He was killed and was laying out in front. It was a horrid thing. But my point is, there's something that's uncivilized inside, for lack of a better word, and it's viscera.
George, how do we make sense of your version of description of that as a soldier and Peter's eloquent description about the honor and the comradeship that he brought back from the battlefield?
Well, no, this is not in answer to his. This is something about the own makeup of human beings, and there's something amiss here. Even when we do memorial service, or even during the last few days on TV, there would be a salute made, and it was done with rifles, shooting off rifles. It's an honorable thing to honor somebody by shooting off a barrel of rifles, men. There's something, and I'm a man, there's something that's amiss, or it's not amiss, it's part of a human condition, but we need to be more civilized about and raise it to a level. Well, I mean, we're
a lot of I'm hearing. Let me just interrupt if I can for a minute, George. I just want to briefly from Chris, because we're coming up to a break. The conflict that we're hearing.
But that's exactly what I think we've been trying to grapple with. I mean, when he talks about the greatest moment of his life, he's talking about that sense of community, that loss of individual consciousness, that being subsumed into the unit, which is so much a part of war. And when your second caller speaks about that death instinct, I think he also understands, and those of us that have been to war, it's so disturbing, that capacity for the destruction of everything, including human life, that lurks within all of us.
Chris Hedges, New York Times reporter, author most recently of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Chris Hedges, New York Times reporter, war correspondent for some 15 years in a bunch of places that he doesn't really want to go back to, but is happy to talk about with us here on the program today. And we're going to Boston. Molly's on the line. Hi, Molly.
Hi. Hello, Chris Hedges.
Hi.
I'm happy to be able to ask you this question because it's something that's bothered me for a while, and you've been in a lot of war-torn areas. You've touched on what Freud defines as the push and pull between life and death instincts, and your callers have talked about the risk-taking and the feelings of community and all these other things. But I'm concerned with why really horrific behavior towards other human beings becomes a norm with people who fight in a war, who would never behave in that way normally. And my specific example is when I read about the El Mazote massacre in El Salvador, I read a description of soldiers picking up small children and as if carrying, you know, mimicking carrying their own, I'm sure, as some of them must have had children, and then throwing them in the air and catching them on their bayonets. And I remember it took me days to just kind of get over my sickness from reading that. And since then, I've read that description over and over and over, from ancient battles to modern warfare, and I was horrified by the fact that that seems to be a really common behavior, along with rape, along with all these other behaviors. So I'm wondering, you who have been in all these areas of the world, these are our neighbors, these are our brothers. How is it that this becomes a normal behavior that can be this way of treating children and treating women?
I think you touch on a really good point. because this is a fundamental component of war, and it is not something that's foreign to us. It's part of the human condition. The fact is, when soldiers are given a license to destroy, it is completely intoxicating. And I've been in towns in Bosnia or El Salvador or other places where they have this complete license to destroy everything, including human life. And their eyes glaze over. They can't even speak. What comes out of their mouth is a kind of gibberish. It is a godlike power that takes over. And it takes over soldiers, especially soldiers in a unit, and they're with this sort of this communal, this herd-like communal feeling that comes over soldiers in a unit, where they no longer have to think. There's this loss of sort of individual consciousness for the collective. It has an orgiastic kind of quality to it.
Well,
and once it begins, it's very hard to stop. I think afterwards there's always great remorse. I think the psychological damage is immense. But I've seen it over and over and over. And there's, you know, one can't discount the massive amounts of adrenaline, the fear, the, you know, that anxiety over your own safety and your own death, which makes you want to lash out. I mean, all of these things combine to craze soldiers, and it's happened in every single war that I've covered. And
you're saying that's part of human nature?
Yes, I think that, and that's why, you know, that's what's so disturbing for people who've spent so much time in war, because it's very hard to resist that kind of pull. The individuals who resisted, and we look at the studies that have been done in World War II, you know, this book by Browning, Ordinary Soldiers, I can't remember the exact name of it, but where he studied this reserve police battalion in Poland. The numbers of people who stand up and resist, you can count on one hand. It's exceedingly hard because one in wartime does not want to be outside of that community, because it's complete ostracism. You're not only completely ostracized, but you lose your identity, because your identity is totally caught up in the unit.
Molly.
Well, I don't think that people with all good intentions waving flags in the United States right now are thinking about any of this. And that's where I feel we are so removed and do feel that modern warfare is a video game. And I'm glad you're talking about this very much. And I also wonder if this is very much a gendered seduction. When you talk about the seduction of war, I think along with the adrenaline, I would think that it's a lot of testosterone too, because I don't think women universally have this kind of response. And, you know, I could be argued with a lot on that, but I think this is a real heavily gendered response, because there's, I think you would find that it's not the same response at all for women.
It's not, you know, in El Salvador, you had women who were part of the FMLN guerrillas. And, you know, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, it's a question I have. I don't have any question that women are just as susceptible to the drug of war, because I've seen it over and over. I saw it in Sarajevo. I mean, in terms of, you know, a group, in terms of a group of soldiers, you know, whether a group of women soldiers would engage in that same kind of destruction, my fear is that they would. But, you know, of course, most of the soldiers I have seen are male, and it's not a question I can answer. But everybody...
You had to go through some of those checkpoints on the way into Sarajevo. Many of those were many of those were staffed by women in the Serb army. I remember, you know, don't go to that checkpoint if you can avoid it, because... You know, that woman runs one of the toughest checkpoints getting in and out of Sarajevo.
Yeah, and I think, Dick, that, you know, one of the things you have to remember about people who make warriors, I mean, one of your callers talked about that need, and one thinks of Achilles, you know, so adept and beautiful on the battlefield, yet so unfit for peacetime society. And one can look at the Odyssey with, you know, Odysseus' 10-year recovery to return to civil society, where he had to conquer, had to curb my hero's heart at one point, Homer writes. So that... I think that it's more, you know, one is attracted to war, and those people that are often relish war the most are those people that have been atomized, as Hannah Arendt writes. So those people that have been are so alienated within a society that war and that the unit that they the units or the soldiers they are with becomes, or those people they are with who are under siege, becomes a kind of surrogate family, that they find what they that perhaps, you know, it's not love, of course, but it looks like love and it feels like love.
Well, there's a perversion as well, where the people most inclined to some kind of misbehavior in society find themselves at the top, calling the shots, able
right,
to set
exactly,
the rules
exactly
for the other people. 1-800-423-8255. Molly, thanks for your call to Fayetteville, North Carolina now, and Robert's on the line. Robert.
Yes, I believe that it is not a normal nature to actually get caught up in that that killing. I got shot down six times in Vietnam. I was a Cobra pilot. And I think one of the important things, important elements that you have is you have to believe as an individual, and your leadership has to explain to you as an individual that you're involved in a just war, as defined by Aristotle and expanded on by St. Thomas Aquinas.
But there was so much debate over just that war where you were shot down, about whether or not it was a just war.
Well, and if you look in retrospect, when we left those people, another 2 million Cambodians were slaughtered. A genocide took place, and almost our history books just gloss over that or absolutely ignore it. I was also and we had good leadership, and if you take the extent to and I don't condone My Lai, I don't condone any kind of atrocity, but if you look at the situation and the leaderships and all the opportunities that could have taken place, they really didn't. It was a very small amount. Leadership was good at your lower level. I think your senior leadership was terrible as far as guidance on the war, but the lower level leadership, both non-commissioned officers and commissioned officers, I thought was exceptional.
Chris, is this a question of leadership?
I don't think, I had to read Just War Theory in seminary, and I don't think that Vietnam met the criteria for just war, first of all. He raised the issue of Cambodia. It was we who invaded Cambodia, replaced the regime, and destabilized the country, essentially laying the ground for Pol Pot. I mean, the notion that somehow our massive military intervention didn't distort Southeast Asia, I think I can't agree with. I think that it's very hard for soldiers who risk their lives, lose friends, and come out of a combat situation to turn around and say, you know, it was all a big mistake and we were used and manipulated. I think it's easier to walk away and retain or believe that the war was justified. But for me, the war in Vietnam is a classic example of where we should not have gone and where we don't want to go now. And, our defeat in Vietnam made us a better nation. It forced us to ask questions that we were not asking before. It forced us to look and see ourselves as others saw us.
Questions we're perhaps not asking now?
I think exactly. I think that since the Persian Gulf War, war has become fashionable again. And the myth of war, the old lie has resurfaced, a lie that the defeat in Vietnam managed to crush. And I think Justice Freud wrote that in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, Eros was ascendant. But in the aftermath of the Persian Gulf War, it's death that is ascendant, and that's what worries me.
So where is the meaning that you're talking about? You say if we get lost in Thanatos, where is it? Is it in Eros?
Yes. In a conflict, the only place you could ever go where there was any sanity was to couples who were in love. And that was true in every war I was ever in. In Bosnia, it was particularly poignant because they were usually mixed couples, a Serb and a Muslim, Muslim and a Croat. People who could not find their identity in the ethnic triumphalism and patent racism of nationalist rhetoric. They had to find that identity between themselves, between their common humanity. And these were always sanctuaries. You know, I very rarely slept well in war, but oftentimes I would stay in houses of friends of couples like this, and war snuffs out the compassionate and the decent and the good. It's not that necessarily they survived. But one felt that power of Eros. And I think ultimately, in order for us to survive as a country, we must recognize a love in others that is like our own. We cannot allow ourselves to dehumanize those. That language of hate, that language of violence, that notion that somehow these are infidels or barbarians, is one that leads directly down that very short path towards the obliteration or eradication of the other.
You're the son of a preacher. You used to troop around with your dad on Sunday mornings in upstate New York from parish to parish.
Now, is that in the book? Where'd you get that?
You asked your dad once, as you write, what do you do when you go into those houses where there's been a death? And your dad's answer is,
mostly I make the coffee. I said, what do you say when you're in a house and people have died? And he said, mostly I just make the coffee.
Now, at the end of your book, after acknowledging all the correspondence that you've sweated with in nasty places, you talk about your own children, Noel and Thomas.
Right.
And the last words that you say remind me of something that Peter said earlier in the program, that for all that I did, I don't want my children involved. And I think your words are,
I hope they never do what I did.
I hope they never do what I did. Does that mean what you did was wrong?
No, it wasn't wrong, but I paid a terrible price to learn. I paid a terrible price to understand. And I am thankful for the understanding, but it came at a terrific cost, as it always does, I think. And I don't want them to have to carry around that cost.
And so when they ask you the same question?
When they ask me which question?
What do you do if you go to a place and there's a dead person there?
You
do more than make coffee.
Well, I mean, I think what my father was saying, that it's a matter of human solidarity, that in the face of the mystery of death, you know, there's not much that we can say. But it is that part of it is just being there, to stand with the bereaved, to stand with those people who have a loss. And that gets to finally what saves us, which is compassion. It's compassion. And compassion for our enemy, compassion for those people, to see in them the same divinity that lies in all of us. And if we can't see that, then we're perhaps doomed, not only doomed to our own destruction, but doomed to become like them.
Chris Hedges, New York Times reporter, author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
This is WB.